Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
For Tuesday, July 17th, 2018, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn about a new effort to provide emergency housing for those in need and find out why shoppers and vendors at some local flea markets say business has been down in recent months following recent immigration crackdowns. We begin, though, with a new plan to help two Valley cities become more sustainable. If you've been to Disneyland or Cambria recently, then you most likely had a swig of highly treated recycled water. Recycled water meaning, yes, it was once in a sewage treatment plant. For many years, this recycled water has helped Orange County meet the needs of its growing population and reduce the toll on its declining aquifers. Soon, the same kind of water may be coming to Clovis and Fresno's drinking water. Reporter Mark Benjamin explains how officials hope these plans will unfold.
Fresno and Clovis have sewage treatment plants equipped to recycle water to a level that meets state drinking water standards. For now, neither city is using the water for drinking because of state rules. Both cities irrigate landscaping with the water. Fresno is starting a pilot program for downtown, southwest Fresno, and Roding Park landscaping. For nearly 10 years, Clovis has been using the highly treated water from its water reuse plant for landscaping too. Now, Clovis and Fresno are planning the next steps. They are among 22 California agencies working with the State Water Board on permits to allow them to deliver some of this water to your tap within a few years. It's an idea whose time has come, says Dan Schlank, professor of environmental toxicology at UC Riverside. Schlank has served on two state water board panels examining emerging contaminants. He says there shouldn't be any concerns about drinking tertiary treated recycled water.
The water that is treated is not the same water that comes out of the toilet. So that water undergoes tremendous amount of treatment that costs a lot of money to do that. So there's so many steps after the toilet part that happen before it even gets to a tap. And I think most people don't realize that.
The point Schlank says is that
every drop of water that you drink comes from someplace else. It may go to the ocean and then get volatilized in the atmosphere, comes down as rain, but every drop of water is recycled.
And this water is safe.
The bottom line is the relative risk is extremely low, if measurable at all.
To make that water drinkable will require the cities to go through the state's permitting process. Mike Carbajal, Fresno's assistant director for the Department of Public Utilities, explains that the city wants to eventually
take some of that recycled water, put it into our existing recharge facilities that we operate. That would allow the water to percolate back into the aquifer over a period of time, and we could subsequently pump that water, become groundwater. We can pump that water back out and utilize it for potable water.
In Fresno, the proposed destination for highly treated water is Leaky Acres at Highway 168 and Ashland Avenue. The city also has a much smaller recharge site west of Fresno. Clovis plans to pipe its treated water to the Marion Avenue Basin for recharge on the city's north side. Once in the basins, the water will mix with river water, percolate into the ground, then into aquifers and wells before going into homes. That plan will require more of a financial commitment from the city's ratepayers or through grants and loans to pay the cost of pipelines, Carbajal says. For decades, Clovis and Fresno relied on groundwater. Carbajal says groundwater levels dropped 100 feet in some areas. In the past 15 years, Fresno and Clovis began using water from local rivers known as surface water. The cities built water treatment plants to clean river water from the Kings and San Joaquin rivers to reduce pressure on wells. But even that isn't enough. Enter California's Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Gary Serrato is general manager for Fresno Irrigation District. He says that
the Central Valley, basically, and it includes all of this area, has been identified as a critically overdrafted basin. What that means, essentially, is that we're taking more out than we're actually putting back in.
Each critically designated basin must have a sustainability plan developed by 2020.
And by 2040, we need to be sustainable. What does that mean? That means basically that of the water that we're extracting from the underground, we're putting a like amount back into the underground so that our groundwater tables do not continue to decline.
And this means using every available water supply, including groundwater recharge, conservation, and recycled water.
We got to look at a better way of how we utilize the wastewater that is provided or developed at the wastewater treatment plant.
Clovis Public Utilities Director Scott Redelfs says the state's requirements loom large.
The ultimate goal, especially with SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, coming into place, is that we don't want to have any negative consequences on the aquifer. So if we can't meet future demand with our water supply, or even if we can, we want to decrease well pumping. And in order to do that, we want to look for every additional available water supply we can get.
Getting recycled water into the two cities' drinking water systems is still a couple of years away. It will take another year or two to complete the permitting process, says Randy Barnard, the state's recycled water unit chief. When that's done, the cities can start building pipelines. Barnard says no water quality issues have been reported to the State Water Board during monitoring.
So if you've ever visited L.A. or you've been to Disneyland and you've drank the water in those areas, you've drank some potable reuse recycled water. Nobody could tell the difference. It's very protective of public health.
The State Water Board also is preparing new rules to allow treated recycled water to get added into a drinking water system or into a raw water supply immediately upstream from a water treatment plant. Those rules are expected in 2023. For Valley Public Radio, this is Mark Benjamin.
Two weeks ago on Valley Edition, we heard about how the Trump administration's immigration policies have been affecting agriculture businesses in the San Joaquin Valley. President Trump's strict rhetoric has many immigrant communities fearful of deportation, especially after announcing his zero-tolerance policy. And it isn't just farmers that are struggling. As Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports, flea markets are seeing a drop in attendance as well.
Jose Robles scrapes up handfuls of dried chilies into a bag for one of his customers at the Cherry Avenue auction in Fresno County. He's been selling chilies and other vegetables at flea markets in the San Joaquin Valley for 19 years. But business has gone down. He says President Trump's recent immigration policies have affected every vendor.
Toda la gente está asustada por todas esas leyes.
Everyone is scared by all those laws that are happening that the government is getting into. A lot of people are traumatized. A lot of people don't want to leave their homes because they have fears of ICE grabbing and deporting them. A lot of people are scared, and that's been affecting all vendors and all commerces in general. Robles says talk of immigration reform and deportations have Latinos in the valley on edge, many whom shop at flea markets. He says less people have been going to flea markets since the ramp-up in immigration policies. Robles is just one of the many vendors Valley Public Radio spoke to who have seen their businesses suffer since the crackdown on immigration. We're selling a third of what we sold in prior years. That's Lodevina Lopez. She also has a stand at the Cherry Avenue auction. She's been selling clothes, shoes, and toys for 11 years. Lopez says she's seen fewer people coming to flea markets since Trump took office. And recently, it's been worse. But it's not just customers. She says it's the workers, too. Because of all the problems we're experiencing with immigration and all the fear that's been infused in people and they continue to put in people, they don't want to return to work here. Lopez says the fear among workers and customers is consistent in other flea markets she works at. She has stands in Selma, Visalia, and Hanford. But she says people shouldn't be as frightened as they are. It's not a fear we should have. We should keep working like always. But yes, a lot of people get scared. The owner of Cherry Avenue Auction has a different perspective. Neil Burson has owned the market for 17 years with his brother. He didn't agree to a recorded interview, but says the drop in business is not related to immigration issues. Burson says economic factors play a larger role, and so does the weather. Frank Parisi with Sunnyside Swap Meet agrees.
Well, when it rains, no one's going to come out in the rain because they can't put their stuff out the water. If it gets too hot, you know, people kind of leave early because of the heat factor, because you're on asphalt, so it, you know, it gets pretty hot out there. So weather is probably one of our biggest factors for the swap meet.
Parisi says he has heard of people being fearful to go to flea markets because of recent immigration policies, but he says it doesn't really affect his swap meet. He says it depends on what area you're in.
You know, there's certain areas like out in the country, you know, there's a lot more of those people that have that type of a situation out there. We don't have that. We have pretty much a little bit better mix of people here. So, but I've heard about that immigration type of thing. We've never had a problem with it here.
But it's the smaller valley towns and rural areas that do depend more on flea markets. Dr. Devra Saxton teaches anthropology at Fresno State. She says flea markets play a vital role in immigrant communities throughout the valley.
Part of it is there aren't a lot of grocery stores or malls in a lot of San Joaquin Valley communities, particularly in the smaller towns and unincorporated communities. But even if you do have access to that, there's something about the remate or the pulga that harkens back to home.
Saxton says many Valley residents come from Mexico, Central America, and Southeast Asian countries, where shopping at open-air markets is a tradition. Whether it be going to socialize or to sell merchandise, she says for Latino immigrants, these markets have a deeply rooted cultural history.
You're able to have conversations with the vendors in your own languages. I mean, there's not just Spanish-speaking vendors, Hmong-speaking vendors. There's also a lot of indigenous-speaking vendors from Oaxaca and Guerrero, and along with those specialty products. So you can have conversations with them that perhaps you can't have in a regular grocery store. So it's not just a commercial space, it's a very social space too.
Flea markets are also critical economic spaces.
Immigrant and low-income entrepreneurs cannot afford retail or storefront space, even in the valley where rents are lower than they are in the Bay Area. And so being able to pay for your booth in the remate or the pulga and to have your hustle, to have your business, and it enables a lot of these families to sustain themselves as well in really critical ways.
Back at the Sunnyside Swap Meet, a Fresno resident says she's here to do just that, socialize and walk around. Norma Lopez zigzags through the aisles of vendors with her grandson. She says he likes coming with her because of the churros. She says lately, and especially since Trump took office, people have been too scared to go out to the flea markets. A lot of people that come to flea markets are undocumented and think ICE is going to come and take them. Like Lopez does, many people come to flea markets for fun and the experience, to take in the smells and tastes of their native countries. Saxton wishes people could think more about what immigrants must go through on a daily basis.
The valley is a very low-income area, and the flea market is where you can go not just to get a good deal, but to kind of be a human and relax and take in the sights and smells and tastes that you enjoy. So it's also, I think, a really critical place of pleasure. And under this administration, people are being repressed and terrified, and they can't even have that simple pleasure of going to the remate anymore. That's really disturbing.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We've been reporting a lot about homelessness lately, but what about families who are on the brink? For some of them, finding stable housing is a way to move their lives forward after drug rehab or court-mandated separation from their kids. Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui reports that one Fresno County program is trying to make it easier for those families to find housing.
Brian Arax is a juvenile dependency court judge. The way he tells it, he sees the worst and best of humanity.
In child welfare, if you're a participant, whether it be a judge or attorney, social worker or other, you get to see the full panoply of the human condition and experience.
The families ARAC sees are often there because of Child Protective Services claims, like neglect. He says a lot of those cases are the effects of drug abuse and addiction. If the child's safety is at risk, they may be separated from their parents for a time and placed with other family or in foster care.
So the judge's role is to come in at certain specific points in time to make key decisions. So there's the first removal of a child, which is always gut-wrenching and agonizing, to hopefully, and in a good number of cases, a reunification.
ARAC says that being reunified, though, is just the beginning.
So when you do that, you have to put your life back together piece by piece by piece. Do you have to get your credit history back, a driver's license, work on a job, and housing is huge.
To fill that housing piece, Fresno County offers some families temporary transitional housing or emergency housing. The location itself is an apartment complex called El Puente, Spanish for the bridge.
It's kind of bridging from homelessness to stability.
Trisha Gonzalez is the deputy director of child welfare for Fresno County. She says that not every family they work with has gone through the child welfare system or was separated from their kids, but all of them suffer from housing instability.
What that means is that we have families that have either unstable housing or they're coming out of a program or they're coming out of homelessness, and they need that stability to care for their children.
El Puente is a place for families to save up for and transition to a permanent space, like their own house or apartment. Families stay for free for about 3 months, but sometimes extensions are granted based on need. Right now, El Puente is going through a transition too. The county is working with the Fresno Housing Authority to relocate the program from Southeast Fresno to Southwest Fresno. The relocation was approved by the County Board of Supervisors just last week. Gonzalez says the new building is definitely an improvement.
We have additional units, so we went from 32 to 46, which means that we can serve more families. We also, our previous units were only 2 bedrooms, and these have some of them up to 4 and 5 bedrooms, which means we can serve larger families.
Gonzalez says the building is often full. It's the same one they've used since the program began in 1974. In the last year, El Puente housed over 300 families. Maria Mendoza is a social worker with the county. She sometimes refers families to El Puente because otherwise they have limited options.
Most shelters in Fresno are constantly full, waitlisted, and there's a huge need for housing. And also the cost of being able to financially just pay for a place to stay is really difficult. So a lot of them experience unstable housing or they have been homeless at one point.
She says that with El Puente often at full capacity, she's had to ask shelters outside the county for help. A building with more units will help her assist more families. And she adds that the old facility could also have used some work.
The building is older, everything's outdated, so I think the new facility will be exciting.
Mendoza says the families she works with are looking forward to the new facility. For them, this is a start of finding stability. The county plans to begin moving into the new building this week and will continue to do so through August. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
This is Valley Edition. The city of Arvin is scheduled to vote on a new oil and gas ordinance tonight, finalizing the decision of the city council on whether they adopt new regulations making it more challenging for oil and gas companies to operate near the city's schools, parks, and neighborhoods. Valley Public Radio's Christina Lopez has more details on the future of the oil and gas industry in Arvin.
The city of Arvin is embraced by its residents as the garden in the sun. But today that garden is surrounded by at least a dozen active oil and gas wells, currently drilling near schools, parks, and homes. Salvador Padilla has lived in Arvin for over a decade, a city with a gas and oil ordinance that has not been updated since the 1960s.
The change it hasn't been done since 1965. Right now we have homes closer to 50 feet away from the oil pumps.
The issue creates disharmony for Pardida, who lives near 2 oil drilling wells.
I have complained to every agency in Kern County that has anything to do with oil companies, oil well, or the control of oil wells, And the only answer that comes back to me is saying that it's a small operator and that they're living with the old ordinance, and under those ordinances, they don't have to do anything.
Bardida's complaints fall on deaf ears as his health concerns continue to mount.
And the noise of this big old diesel engine, it runs all night long. And when all the traffic comes down on the streets and everything in the middle of the night, you can hear that diesel engine run like if it was a truck right next to your window. The noise doesn't stop. That's 24/7. And the oil smelled of the crude oil, you can smell it a mile away. And that smells horrible, and that gets you sick.
Arvin's landscape and the health of its residents could change after 6 o'clock tonight, as gas and oil industry members, community leaders, including Bardida, as well as local working families, are expected to pack the 80-seat City Hall chambers for a public hearing, resulting in a final vote to update the city's 53-year-old gas and oil ordinance for regulation of petroleum facilities and operations. Tracy Leach is the founder of the Kern Citizens for Energy Coalition and calls tonight's vote significant.
This oil production is our history. It's our heritage. We've been doing it for over 100 years here. So having a city in Kern County take such a pretty hostile position to oil production and the tens of thousands of jobs it provides is a little startling.
Leach says the new ordinance makes oil and gas production manageable in the city of Arvin. Despite the significant changes, Leach is more concerned with the mayor of Arvin's recent comments surrounding the ordinance.
The mayor has stated he wants to ban the industry, so we strongly objected to his posture towards his own home county.
What this ordinance does is it allows the oil industry to operate within the city of Arvin with reasonable regulations that are focused on public health and safety and dictate where oil operations can and cannot occur within the city of Arvin.
That's Jose Gorula, the current mayor of Arvin and a native of this rich agricultural region of Kern County. He, too, has been directly impacted by the oil industry 4 years ago when a gas leak was located in his neighborhood. He disagrees with industry insiders when they label the updated ordinance a ban.
Yes, you can operate within our community, but with public health and safety in mind. I think that is what they're concerned, and I think they're the ones that are using talking points and misinformation and political attacks to call this what it isn't. They're saying this is a ban.
Earlier this month, Arvin City Council held its first public hearing with a preliminary vote on an updated oil and gas ordinance, with 70% of the community supporting stricter regulations against the oil and gas industry within city limits.
There were quite a few members of the community there, and they spoke on both sides of the issue. And the industry representatives there all objected to the ordinance as it was exempting itself from CEQA and not doing environmental review.
Currently, there are 10 to 12 active oil wells operating in the city of Arvin. Under the new ordinance, which will take effect 30 to 60 days following the final vote, the city will implement new regulations with a clear focus on the city's public health concerns.
What it does, and I guess the most controversial aspect of the ordinance, is it creates a public health buffer zone or setback. So between 300 feet or within 300 feet of sensitive uses, there can't be any oil or gas operations. And also within 50 to 100 feet within streets, can't occur any oil and gas operations. Now from 300 to 600 feet, any oil and gas development there will trigger additional rules with respect to noise, any nuisances, and that's because it's close to sensitive areas.
These sensitive areas include schools, parks, and homes. As night breaks, the roar of an oil well churns just feet away as churchgoers exit St. Thomas the Apostle Catholic Church on Bear Mountain Boulevard. Tonight's vote is expected to surpass the roar of those oil wells with overwhelming support. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Christina Lopez in Arvin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For years, local medical and political leaders have been calling for a medical school in the San Joaquin Valley. Now the long-running UCSF Fresno graduate medical education program is getting a boost towards that goal. The university has announced that it's upgrading the Fresno program status to that of an official branch campus of UCSF. Dean Michael Peterson joins us now to tell us more. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much, Joe.
So UCSF Fresno has been here in the Central Valley since around 1975. So what's changing with this new announcement of the designation as an official campus of UCSF?
Yeah, so as you pointed out, we were created in 1975. And if you look at the process by which physicians train, medical school is just the beginning. Once you graduate from medical school, then you do your residency training and maybe even subspecialty training at the fellowship level. And so the focus in Fresno from the beginning was to really have it be about residency training and fellowship training. And that's really been the focus of what we've done for most of this 43 years that we've been involved in this. Over the last 10 to 15 years, we've started to have more involvement in the training of medical students. And with the introduction of the San Joaquin Valley Prime Program, which was a collaborative among UC Merced, UC Davis, UCSF, and our campus, we started to have a cadre of students who were spending a significant amount of time with us, a year or more, in that program. As we have matured that program, we've realized that it's becoming logistically very difficult to be doing graduate medical education under one medical school, undergraduate medical education under two different schools, and try and coordinate all of that. And so in joint meetings among the faculty leadership and the Office of the President, the decision was made to transition that program to a UCSF program. And with that, UCSF made the commitment that the students, at least initially, will spend at least 2.5 years in the Central Valley in training. And as we build the capacity, hopefully with other universities, Fresno State, University of California, Merced, we would be able to deliver the entire 4 years of that undergraduate curriculum here in the Central Valley so that students would be recruited specifically into this program and spend all of their time training in this region, working with the patient populations here. This is really an important step because the ultimate goal is to have a medical school in the Central Valley, and this is a stepwise process that, for example, UC Riverside went through, where we will build our capacity, develop the resources, expand the patient, the student population that we could do, and ultimately be able to have an independent medical school in the Central Valley. So the real important event for us is accreditation at the national level with recognition that this will be a branch medical school campus. Students will be spending a substantial amount of time here, recruited specifically to be in this program, and hopefully be the step along the process for developing a full independent school in the Central Valley.
So this essentially is the evolution of that San Joaquin Valley Prime program. Does it have a net increase, or is your vision for a net increase in the number of slots?
So right now we have about, I think, 34 students over the four years. We will be recruiting classes of students at 12 initially. Once we can identify the kinds of resources that are sustainable and ongoing, our goal is to move to 50 students a year.
You mentioned that we have this shortage of physicians and this is important for the Valley. Tell me a little more about that. Why is this important for the Valley?
So I think that a couple of really important things happen when you can coalesce around a branch campus of medical school. Number one is this helps us to recruit physicians into the region because the opportunity to interact with and work with medical students will attract physicians that might not otherwise come into a region. Secondly, the two most important things that will predict where a physician will end up practicing is where they grew up and where they finish their training. In addition, we know that the longer a physician in training is in a region, the more likely it is that they will, you know, develop family ties, that they will develop roots in a community and therefore stay in a community. So we think that the ability to recruit in students from the region who would be able to see themselves as having a continuum of training where they could do all of it in the valley, the both in Fresno as well as surrounding communities, and they come from the valley, that those two things together will increase our ability to retain the people that we are training. Right now, we retain somewhere between 45 and 55% of the physicians in the residency and fellowship programs in the region. We would hope that with the medical school feeder stream that we could increase that to 70% or better. So that will, those two things will help to attract physicians into the region.
How much is this project going to cost?
So for the 12 students a year, we have ongoing funding through the work of Assemblyman Adam Gray a couple of years ago, obtained enhancement funding for the program up to 12 students. So that together with the other support we have, as well as tuition support that the students would generate, that's where I said we're comfortable that we have all the resources to be able to train the 12 students. In order to go to the 50 students a year, will require that we have an additional $20 to $22 million a year to put into the program. So one of the things that we're looking at trying to do with the help, again, of some of our local representatives is to establish an endowment that would then generate sufficient interest payments so that you would have the $20 to $22 million in order to do that. And that endowment requirement would be somewhere in the range of $450 to $500 million.
Is this a step towards a standalone medical school in Fresno in this program, or is that even really important at this point?
So the end goal is to have an independent medical school, and exactly where that would reside, I think the important part is that we'd be in the Central Valley and serving the Central Valley. And that is the end goal of this project, is to get there. Now, I can't tell you how many years it's going to take to get there, because a lot of it depends upon how long does it take us to grow the capacity to increase the students, how quickly can we build some of the relationships that we need to have with other universities in the region to deliver the components of medical education that we can't do right now. So our history has been very strong in providing good clinical training, but the basic science training requires a different resource than we have right now, but one that we think we can collaborate with the universities in the region to be able to deliver.
Dean Michael Peterson of UCSF Fresno announcing the big change in status there as the Fresno Graduate Medical Education Program transitioning to be its own campus under the UCSF Medical School. Dean Peterson, thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest, and thanks for your time.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's not as famous or as spicy as the jalapeno or the habanero, but the humble Fresno chili is starting to get its due. A new piece in the online food magazine Eater.com extols the virtues of this little pepper that could by digging into its history and searching out those who love its intriguing yet approachable flavor. Ryan Bradley joins us now on Skype. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So before we get into the origins of the Fresno chili, tell me, why do you think this particular chili pepper is so unique?
Honestly, it was, I thought it was a delicious pepper. I first sort of was struck by it in a dish that featured the Fresno chili. And it had, you know, in the piece I describe it as similar to a jalapeno, but different. It's a bit more complex. It has a similar spice level. The heat doesn't ever really overwhelm, but it's also sort of smoky and sweet. And it just was interesting to me. And then that kind of sent me off on a quest to find out as much as I could about the Fresno chili. Starting with, was it actually from Fresno, California? Which at first when I heard it was a Fresno chili, I, like a lot of people I've later found out, kind of assumed it was from like Fresno, Mexico, or someplace more exotic, frankly, than Fresno, California.
So it turns out, Ryan, the Fresno chili, as I understand it, is actually from Clovis?
Yeah, that's right. So the Fresno chili is named after the county of Fresno, not the city. It was a seed grower, I guess a seed merchant, who first hybridized the Fresno and named it after the county. And he was based in Clovis. Brown Hamlin was his name. And this was in the 50s.
So how does the Fresno fit into the overall history of the chili pepper?
One of the more unique things about it is that it's a newish pepper in the long, you know, 5,000 plus year history of humans developing their own unique chili peppers. But then in the last couple of decades, as I write about in my story for Eater, there's been this real explosion in unique peppers that really mostly is concentrated around growing the hottest pepper that you possibly can. And the Fresno is specifically not very hot. It's a pretty friendly pepper. So I also sort of hypothesize that part of the thing that the Fresno, that has caused the Fresno to be, you know, not lost, but doesn't have the recognition that it, I think it deserves, is because it's not exceptionally hot, whereas a lot of the newer peppers coming out are ridiculously hot, are not for normal person consumption, I would say.
So where did you eventually get your breakthrough on the little pepper that could?
I wanted to visit a field of growing Fresno chili peppers and talk to some Fresno chili pepper growers. So I'd say my breakthrough in understanding the pepper and seeing it and talking to people who worked with it was twofold. I found a pepper grower who works sort of in Ventura County. And then I sort of spur of the moment just drove up to Fresno and then had this really wonderful day in and around Fresno meeting with various chefs and growers and people who are in the ag industry. And there aren't that many actually in the ag industry around Fresno who deal with Fresno chilies, but the few I met who knew about Fresno chilies were really enamored of them. And so it was great. Their enthusiasm was great. And I felt like I learned a lot from that day in the Central Valley.
Now you did in your travels talk to a number of people who do use this pepper. For them, it's all about flavor. Tell me a little more about the people you met and what you found.
Yeah, so the first dish that sort of put it on my radar was from a restaurant here in LA called BS Taqueria. And the chef there, Ray Garcia, immediately just, I talked to him about it and he was like, you know, it's a very kind of friendly gateway pepper and it's a crowd pleaser. He puts it in this amazing rice and beans dish. Then when I drove up to Fresno, the first person I met was Vincent Ricucci. His family runs PR Farms, which is a big farming concern. They grow all sorts of stuff. They grow a lot of almonds and grapes and apples and olives. And Vincent runs Enzo, which is an olive oil company. A couple years ago, he started making a crushed chili oil with Fresno chilies. I bought a bottle of this and I got to say, I use it all the time and now. And he started doing it because he wanted to do a chili oil. And then Fresno's were kind of on his radar, but not totally. But in the same way, he was like, oh, this is cool. This is a cool, it's named after where I'm from. And then the more he looked into it, and I think after trying some, he really realized it was just a great, very approachable pepper to go in this oil. And then the guy who helped him get set up, because his family, you know, he's not a vegetable grower. They do mostly stone fruit. So the guy who set Vincent up with his peppers, Kong Tao, who is just an amazing, amazing grower. He and Tao Family Farms is his family farm. So he and his parents and some of his siblings, they grow some of the best produce in America. I mean, their produce is super sought after by all sorts of chefs in LA and San Francisco and New York. Even some of his stuff gets flown out to New York. So Kong helped Vincent get set up with his peppers. I went over, saw his farm, which was an amazing place to see because he grows such a preposterous variety of stuff, all sorts of peppers, including he had a little patch of Fresno peppers. And both Vincent and Kong's peppers were just coming in. I mean, it was early in the pepper season when I went up there, so they don't really look like much until later in the summer, fall. But then Kong mentioned another local guy, Jimmy Pardini, who runs the Annex Kitchen, which is right next to his family's dining hall, banquet hall, that's been there for a very long time. Anyway, the Annex uses a bunch of Kong's produce and sometimes their Fresno chilies, and they also use Vincent's chili oil. So talked to Jimmy for a little while. And oh, a great story that sort of sent me full circle back to fancy restaurants in LA. So the reason that Jimmy Pardini knew about Fresno chilies was when he was working in the kitchen of Osteria Mazza, which is a fancy Italian restaurant run by Nancy Silverton, who's a great LA chef. That's when he first encountered Fresno chilies in a linguine with clams dish. And he had this great description of first encountering this Fresno chili. He's a guy from Fresno, and he said, was this like Fresno, the place where I'm from? Or he kind of, similar to me, assumed it was a Fresno in Mexico or somewhere further afield. And then, you know, to talking to other chefs back in LA and elsewhere, everyone who had encountered the pepper used it, you know, often and in several dishes, just again, because it delivers a really interesting flavor without too much spice and just livens up a lot of otherwise sort of traditional dishes. So yeah, I on this whole kind of quest to understand the pepper, I really ended up falling in love with it even more. I mean, I think it's one of the more unheralded American foods. And the other thing that Jimmy brought up and others also brought up that I thought was really interesting is that peppers, you know, peppers are from the Americas, from Mexico, but then, you know, they spread all over the world, kind of post Columbus and then through trade, and have come back to America through all these different immigrant communities in astounding different ways, and are very much a part of, obviously very much a part of Mexican cooking, but also very much a part of different Asian cuisines, Italian cuisines. But there are specific varieties of pepper, you know, that have been part of that cuisine for centuries. And because the Fresno is from the 50s, it hasn't been around that long, it hasn't been really adopted by these long traditions of regional cooking in the way that other peppers have. So I hope that my article at least makes a case for the Fresno chili being able to work its way into more people's cooking. It's kind of a great American pepper.
Is it possible, though, that the Fresno chili is already having its cultural moment, or at least at the early stages of that? You write that the grower of the sriracha, the peppers that make up sriracha sauce, just planted more Fresno chilies than ever this year. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So the one of the guys, the first pepper grower I spoke to, is, you know, he no longer grows the jalapenos for sriracha. He had a falling out with the sriracha guy, but he's a very serious pepper grower. And his farm manager noticed that at the Terminal Market down in LA, the big produce market here, he was noticing more and more Fresnos and that they were going for higher and higher prices. They're a bit more in demand. That's a good indicator. I mean, that's different than my local supermarket or farmer's market indicator, that the Terminal Market is a pretty specifically kind of wholesale market. But it does lead me to think that they are having a moment. I mean, at least there's more demand for them. So growers who are savvy about this stuff are going to be growing more of them too. So,
and hopefully all the people that read your column as well, your article in Eater.
Yeah, I hope so. What's also great about them is you can incorporate them into any recipe that calls for a jalapeno. You can just swap in a Fresno and it's going to taste a little bit different. And I think a little bit more complex. I don't want to necessarily say better, but I think it's worth experimenting with them. They're really fun. And you can, I mean, all peppers are so kind of wonderfully usable in all sorts of dishes. You know, you can cook with them, you can grill with them. Obviously, you can bake with them. You can dry them out and crush them on stuff. You can make jellies out of them, and obviously you can make oils out of them. They're a great piece of summertime produce. And it's cool to see that there's a hint of, and I hope more of, around Fresno pride for this pepper, because, you know, Fresno's in the middle of the produce capital of the country, if not the world, and here's this pepper named after it. So yeah, I love, actually, a guy who I spoke to for the piece too, who didn't make it in the story, used to live in Fresno, and he his first tattoo, he has a tattoo of a Fresno chili. I was told I should talk to him because he's possibly the only guy on earth that has a tattoo of a Fresno chili. And he, similar to me, I mean, I don't have a tattoo of the Fresno chili, but he similarly was just like, well, I mean, I, as soon as I found out about this pepper, I was living in Fresno and I just loved this pepper, and it seemed to represent the town and the place, and it's this really nice looking pepper. So he got a tattoo of it, and you know, now he lives in New Orleans, but whenever people see it, they always think it's a jalapeno, which is a common error with Fresno's. He always corrects them.
We've been talking with journalist Ryan Bradley. His new article, The Little Pepper That Could, extols the virtues of the Fresno chili, a California native that was hybridized right here in Fresno County and is apparently starting to get some larger attention from beyond just this immediate area. You can find it online at eater.com. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's being billed as the largest choral event in the history of California. 10,000 singers in 6 venues across the state, all performing at once. It's called the Big Sing California, and it's coming to Fresno's Paul Sheguyan Concert Hall this Saturday. Anna Hamry of the Fresno Community Chorus joins us now to tell us more. Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
Anna, how is this going to work? You have a satellite link set up between all these venues and the Disney Concert Hall. Tell me more.
Wait, yeah, it's going to be very exciting. We will be, it's the Fresno Master Chorale that's hosting the local hub. We will be in the Sheguyan Hall, and we'll be connected via electronic equipment with Disney Hall and the other hubs in San Diego, Sacramento, Riverside, and San Francisco.
So how do you go about preparing for something like this? I imagine it's a different sort of challenge than you normally have with a regular concert with the Master Chorale at Sheguyan. There's no video screen or live feed in those cases.
Right, right. This is a different kind of thing. So we'll practice Thursday night for those who can show up, and then we just get together and sing on Saturday. Actually, this is a no-stress event. We invite people, regardless of their background abilities, to come and join us. They can still show up and be with us on Saturday, and we will simply sing along to the live feed we're getting from Disney Hall.
So how did you get connected with this group and get to be a part of this? There's LA, San Diego, San Francisco, Sacramento, Riverside, Fresno. How did all of these come together?
Well, this is a grant from the James Irvine Foundation that led the way with the Master Chorale from Los Angeles. And then they asked directors of Master Chorales around the state to help out with hubs. And they asked us to be the hub choir, the host choir for Fresno. And we're very excited. It fits right into our mission statement.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. Is this sort of an easy entry point for people to who maybe have never been to a choral music concert before?
Absolutely. This music, there'll be some more art music, but, you know, it's also Hey Jude, and I bet a lot of people can sing along on Hey Jude.
They already know the words. Again, Anna Hamry of the Fresno Community Chorus and Fresno Master Chorale joining us today, talking about this event coming up on Saturday. It's free at the Paul Sheguyan Concert Hall, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Big Sing California. Anna, we're having an event here at the station on Wednesday talking about the future of arts organizations in the Valley, and that's open to the public. People can attend that. It's free as well. But one of the things we're talking about is how do arts organizations try new things? You're doing something new here with the Master Chorale and this.
using technology. Is there a new opportunity here to try to reach different audiences and things than you might normally do?
Well, there most definitely is a new opportunity here, and we rely on Vince Keenan, who is the technical expert at the Sheboygan Hall, to be our technical link with the Disney Hall. But this is a no-stress event. It's just to highlight the joy of singing. Scientists have told us for a long time of what's going on in our bodies chemically, why it's so uplifting to sing particularly together. And it's going to be a bonding experience, you know, it's part of our mission statement to build community in Fresno. And today life is so divided, you know, politics, race, wealth, whatever it is, it's important to find events that actually build community. And this gives us a really great opportunity to do that.
In the orchestral world, we often see concert schedules divided between pops and traditional repertoire. Is there maybe less of a line in the choral world, or is that clear cut?
Well, it's pretty clear cut when you have very definite classical music. But, you know, there is so much popular music that appeals to absolutely everybody that we have a huge body of literature that we can rely on.
Speaking of that huge body of literature with some excellent classical pieces, this next season that's coming up for the Master Chorale has some real gems. Tell us about your own solo concerts and the one that's coming up in November with the Philharmonic.
Yeah, it's going to be a very big season. Our first concert is October 28th, which is a festival of music for choir, brass, and organ, which will be at Hope Church. Our big performance in the fall will be the Britain War Requiem with the Fresno Phil. This has been in the planning for several years because it's such a monumental work. It's so monumental. It has two choirs. It has two orchestras. We have to block off the first couple of rows of the Sheboygan Hall, excuse me, so that for the performers, the audience, we can't sell those seats because we will have to use those for performing area. So it's a huge event celebrating, honoring, observing the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice ending World War I. That will be monumental. Another monumental work will be the St. John Passion by J.S. Bach in April, at the end of April, April 28th. Another major, very classical work.
Sounds like a great concert series. Again, if people want more information, how can they find it about any of these events?
Right. Well, the best thing is to go to our website, which is, if you just Google FresnoCommunityChorus.org, you will find out about all of our choirs, not just the Master Chorale, but the concerts and opportunities that will occur in the Fresno area.
All right. Well, that sounds great. And again, we thank you for joining us today, Anna Hamry of the Fresno Community Chorus and Master Chorale with the Big Sing California this Saturday at 2 o'clock. Six venues all linked together with technology. Everyone's singing along, and it sounds like a lot of fun.
It will be fun.
Thanks so much. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can subscribe to our podcast and get all of our stories on demand on our website, kvpr.org. You'll also find the link to download our mobile app for iOS and Android, and you can leave your comments there as well, kvpr.org. And also, RSVP for our Be Public Live event taking place tomorrow evening, 6 o'clock, at the Barman Cheney Performance Studio here in Clovis. It's talking about the future of arts organizations, and we'll have representatives from the Selma Arts Center, Arte Americas, and the Fresno Philharmonic talking about how their organizations are adapting to a changing valley. That's a free event, and you can also find it on our website, kvpr.org. For reporter and producer Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, Christina Lopez, and Mark Benjamin, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment, Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.